Radio power for the people. 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
It's Monday morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Today, on our final show of 2013, hosts Robin Martinez and David Bell are joined by Eric Vernon to make up our panel of local lawyers who will recap the legal news of the year. They have come up with a long list of important decisions and cases. Then, in the second half of the show, we open up the phone lines for your nominations of Legal Story of the Year. There is no calendar on today's show, but remember to stick around for the 420 drug war news after the show. Now, let's get started with Robin, David, and Eric.
Good morning, everybody. This is Robin Martinez. I'm an attorney with the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. This morning, joining me is attorney David Bell and also Eric Vernon. We're here for the to give you a little bit of information about the very important legal decisions that were that affect all of us that occurred over the past year, and to engage in a little bit of discussion about maybe what some of the top legal stories of the year were. Welcome to the show, David and Eric. Probably, let's start right at the top. One of the biggest topics that seems to have exploded on the scene over the years has been drug policy reform. It seems that there's a growing movement across the country. You've had marijuana, for instance, legalized both in the states of Washington and just a couple states over in Colorado. And that's engendered a lot of discussion about the entire panoply of drug policy issues. Any thoughts on that, gentlemen?
Well, I had thought, in discussing this beforehand and reviewing some of the things that happened this year, I thought one of the biggest messages we're getting from the government was the president's most recent pardons. So President Obama just recently pardoned 8 people who had been convicted for cocaine conspiracies, and they'd been convicted and sentenced years ago under the draconian sentencing laws that several of them for essentially very small offenses because they were convicted in large conspiracies, they were sentenced to life in prison, several of them.
So what were those disparities?
Well, and the disparities, one of the reasons it's a big issue is because back in the day, there was a disparity between the sentences for powder cocaine and crack cocaine, that somebody sentenced to crack cocaine would have a sentence 100 times greater than somebody who was convicted of selling powder cocaine, the same amount of powder cocaine. Recently, back in 2010, the Congress changed it so that now the disparity is only 18-1, but there's still a large disparity. In any case, it seems to me that this was a message from the president that he was wanting and willing to talk about, making the change to the disparities retroactive, because these people that were sentenced 20 years ago to life in prison were not benefited, did not receive any benefit from the change in the law in 2010.
Yeah, this is David. I one of the things that differentiates the federal criminal laws from state in terms of drugs is, first of all, the feds are driven by weight, significant amount of weight, and I think Eric was talking about the weight was 100-1 disparity from crack to cocaine. The other thing that differentiates it, in my experience, is that at the state level, the drug crimes are generally charged based on what the police find. So they arrest someone on their person as an ounce or 2 ounces of cocaine or crack or whatever it may be. At the federal level, there's a concept that I think the slang is ghost dope. And so in the many conspiracies, they don't even have the weight. They don't find the weight to which they attribute to the various persons. So I could be sentenced for 100 pounds of a drug that is never found on my person or is never found at all, but rather some informant or someone else who wants to get cooperation points just places upon me. And that's a big difference. And so when we talk about these mandatory minimums and we take those factors into account, I think it heightens the importance of them.
Well, and then that's the other issue. It's not just the disparity, it's the mandatory minimums. So in these federal drug cases, based on being involved in conspiracies, people are faced with mandatory minimums of 10, sometimes 15, or even 20 years based on their criminal history or whether or not a gun is involved. And so just for being involved in a conspiracy but personally only selling a small amount of drugs, people can be looking at these massive sentences.
So are you seeing any pushback then on mandatory minimums?
Well, and that's one of the things I was getting at with the President's pardons is I think he's indicating that he is interested in reform, and there are other people in the Congress and the Senate that are that seem to be interested. In fact, just last week there was this tweet fest between Senator Rand Paul and Senator Cory Booker about, well, it started with them just talking about bipartisanship, and it ended with them talking about working together to reform the mandatory sentences.
Right, and the other problem is not just the mandatory minimum, and the other what's underlying all of this is the criminalizing the conduct to such an extent that someone's labeled for the rest of their life as a felon. So even if you get rid of these mandatory minimums, which I have not been seeing a lot of it in terms of my interactions with the U.S. Attorney's Office, but let's say even we get rid of those mandatory minimums, as indicated by a Holder memo, you still have a situation where pretty much everyone charged with a drug crime at the federal level is going to be a felon. And there is no expungement at the federal level. So if you get caught with an ounce and you're charged in a conspiracy because someone's bringing in from Mexico that you've never met, but you're still part of that conspiracy, you plead, even if you get probation, which is highly unlikely, but let's say you do, you're still stuck as a felon for the rest of your life. So there's still significant collateral consequences, even if you take out the mandatory minimum.
Now, you mentioned the Holder memorandum. What is that?
Well, essentially, he said he said the Department of Justice and the U.S. attorneys need to take a closer look at people's roles in offenses and decide whether or not they really need to meet some criteria for requiring the mandatory minimums. The law used to be that if the government charged somebody with being part of a conspiracy, they were looking automatically at these 10-year mandatory minimums. The law now, there's a Supreme Court case this year that came out that said, and it's kind of complicated, but essentially says the jury's got to decide the elements of the offense that make it reach the mandatory minimum. So if it's an amount of cocaine, the jury has got to decide that. And using that Supreme Court case, Attorney General Holder has said, if we don't allege, if we pick out the people that were not that, not at the top of the food chain of a conspiracy, and we don't allege the requisite amount of drugs, if we just say they were involved in a conspiracy, they're no longer looking at a mandatory minimum. So he's basically saying we need to, the government needs to exercise a little bit more discretion and maybe not go after the low-level participants with these massive mandatory minimums.
I think the other place I see this coming to bear is that even in the smaller participants, the really minor participants in the drug conspiracy, they'll still get hit with a mandatory minimum charge, let's say the 10-year minimum that Eric spoke about, and then that'll be used as a point of leverage to get them to cooperate. And then in exchange for their cooperation, they'll drop that minimum. So I'm curious to see if this Holder memo will have the government come forward and not play that kind of leverage game. Charge them originally with what's the right thing to charge them with. Don't hit them with the 10-year mandatory minimum with the idea of bargaining off of that, but hit them with something that doesn't have the mandatory minimum to begin with.
Now, that has been a fairly consistent complaint that we've been hearing lately, is that prosecutors have a tendency to overcharge defendants primarily for the purpose of gaining leverage. Is that something that you see out there consistently?
Well, I think, as David said, the Department of Justice, yes, they will charge everybody in a conspiracy with the large conspiracy, and so then the little mule or the girlfriend of the drug dealer who happens to be there at the time, they all get hit with these mandatory minimum 10 years, and then, just as David said, they use that as leverage. I don't know I don't see that often in state cases, but in drug conspiracies with the federal government, that is part of the practice, or at least it has been, and I think, the jury is still out on whether or not there's going to be a change.
Now, to what extent do you think perhaps that this larger push towards drug policy reform is maybe budget driven by the fact that there's so many people in prisons, and perhaps we just can't afford to keep people locked up? Do you see that playing into it?
Yeah, you know, I don't spend a lot of time in Jefferson City or Washington, D.C., so I don't know that I can speak to that.
I think my feeling is that is the only criteria that will affect change in this area. When people run out of money, I mean, people want to imprison others for a variety of acts, and it almost seems limitless. But when you come up against a criteria of, well, how much do you want to spend of your own money to do that, then people start to question it. And we see that with, I think, partially with the Holder memo that's coming out, and I think you'll see that more and more as prisons fill up.
Now, one final point on drug policy reform. As I mentioned earlier, we had the legalization efforts in both Washington and Colorado, and I understand that legalization is going to be on potentially even on the ballot in Missouri sometime down the road. There was a memorandum that was recently issued by Deputy Attorney General James Cole that talked about what the Department of Justice would do in terms of allowing states to experiment with various efforts towards drug policy reform. Do you see that maybe as being an additional signal that we may be looking at some kind of a sea change in terms of reform?
I think so. But just to be clear, at the state level right now, low levels of marijuana, in particular what would be considered personal use, are not the object of a lot of the law enforcement action. In fact, I recall, let's say 5 or 6 years ago, I went along on a ride-along with a local agency, and they found marijuana on someone, and they just ground it into the dirt. Now, that's not doesn't happen always, but that doesn't seem to be a major focus. I think the bigger issue is what happens when you move into non-personal use. And that I don't know how the feds are going to handle it. It seems to me under Obama and this current administration, they're going to take a hands-off approach to if the states legalize the use of it. But I'll tell you right now, I'm sure Eric sees it, I know I see it as well, is, you know, Kansas law enforcement is having a heyday catching people coming in from Colorado to deliver the products. And so it's interesting to see two states right next to each other that have terribly divergent drug policies.
And I chuckle. In fact, I see that in Missouri as well. If you're driving through Missouri with Colorado plates, you are just—it's almost rolling probable cause, I think.
Yeah. No, that's that or a rental car.
Right.
That's kind of a scary thought in terms of the Fourth Amendment principles. Then, but speaking of the Fourth Amendment, let's shift gears a little bit away from drug policy reform and maybe talk about one of the larger sort of issues that came across nationally, and that was the NSA's data collection. And two very important, I think, cases were just decided within the last few weeks or the last month or so. On the Fourth Amendment and the unconstitutionality or the relative constitutionality of the data collection. Any thoughts on those issues?
Well, it just said it's going to be interesting to watch. I note that, in the last month, a federal district judge out of Washington, D.C., Judge Leon, ruled that the NSA's data collection process is unconstitutional. And just a few weeks later, a judge out of New York, a federal district judge, Polly, out of New York, ruled that it was constitutional. Now, those are just district-level judges. They're going to have to be appealed to their respective circuits. And if they continue to have a split like that, it may someday soon arrive at the Supreme Court. But I think at this point, we're just interested to sit back and watch and see how they fall out.
I think for me, I'd like to see how this information is used in the domestic arena. You know, one of the problems we see in Fourth Amendment litigation is if a law enforcement officer has the right to search or to enter a premises or a car or search a person, then whatever they find there can be used against the individual, even if what they find was not the original point of the search. So if the cops patting someone down for weapons and they come across something that's obviously drugs, they're able to seize those drugs and use that against the person. I remember in New York when they were searching backpacks as you're going on the subways for I think it was a terrorist to try to prevent terrorism. If they found drugs or found weapons, they were able to use those against you. Anytime law enforcement is able to get somewhere legally, the concern is how are they going to use that information? And the problem is there's no limit to it because once they're in there, they're in there. And they can use it for whatever purpose. I think to me that is also a big concern here seeing how these cases play out in the courts.
Now, there were some reports in the media that the federal government was using data that was gathered by the NSA to essentially feed to law enforcement and then let law enforcement essentially backdoor into into their investigations. I mean, do you see that as being particularly problematic?
Well, yeah, and more problematic than that is even the secrecy surrounding all this, because I'm not sure, as a criminal defense attorney representing somebody in federal court, I'm not sure how we determine that that has actually occurred.
I think that's a great point. There's not going to be, given the secrecy around it, I'm not sure we're going to get a report saying that this is how someone backdoored into it. So we'll just get that. I don't know how it'll come across that someone just stepped into it almost randomly, but we'll never get that back information. And the idea of being able to get to it by subpoena power or otherwise seems almost an insurmountable task. That's the really scary part. You'll never know.
And so, at least in my mind, that it really is almost a very dangerous attack on the integrity of the entire justice system then.
Right, which I think is the underlying problem of being able to kind of dragnet of information. I think that's the underlying concern that everyone has.
Okay. Let me go ahead and reintroduce you here now. This is Robin Martinez. I'm an attorney with the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. With me today are attorneys David Bell and Eric Vernon. We're talking about a number of important legal issues that arose over the past year. You're listening to us on Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM Community Radio. Let's talk a little bit about some of the significant Supreme Court cases that occurred over the last year. There were some pretty big ones. One was, and we talk about data privacy and collection, there was a case involving a GPS surveillance. Can you tell us a little bit about that one, Eric? I know you've got a particular interest in that case.
Well, and I did, because it was, and this is actually about a year and a half old, but about a year and a half, 2 years ago, there was the U.S. v. Jones. Mr. Jones had been suspected by the government of being involved in selling drugs in the Washington, D.C. area, and they did a whole bunch of surveillance. They had pull cameras out in front of his nightclub, and they followed him around some, and they wiretapped his phone. But they just weren't getting the goods, so to speak, and so they got a warrant to place a GPS tracker on his car. But then they erred. They screwed up by not putting the tracker on within the limits of the warrant. The warrant said, the judge had said, you can go put this GPS tracker on in the next 10 days in Washington, D.C. And they waited until the 11th day, and they installed it when the car was in Maryland. So they violated the warrant. So this was basically a warrantless search, or at least that was the issue. Is this a warrantless search? And the or invasion of the guy's privacy. And by using the GPS tracker, they followed him wherever he went for a month. And they were able to find that he kept going to this one house, and they went to the house, and they got a search warrant, and they found a whole bunch of drugs and the money, and he ended up getting convicted and getting life in prison. So they contested the warrantless use of this GPS tracker that they had put on his car. And probably the most interesting part of the holding, Justice Scalia ruled for a sort of divided court, saying that this was an unconstitutional invasion. And he based it on some very old concepts of trespass. He essentially said that that our persons and ourselves and our property are under the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution inviolable. And the police, by taking this device and installing it on his car without his permission and without a warrant, they trespassed upon his property, and that is what violated the Fourth Amendment. And so they threw out the evidence, and the guy got a new trial. Meanwhile, but I say it was a divided court because there was a concurring opinion. The several of the justices, enough of the justices agreed that it was unconstitutional that they were able to rule that way. But I think it was Justice Sotomayor wrote a concurrence where she said essentially the way Scalia got there was good enough, and so I'm going to agree with him. But really, we need to look at the reasonable expectation of privacy. And I think most legal scholars kind of thought that's the way the court was going to rule, based on this reasonable expectation of privacy. Because her point was, you know, in this information age and in this electronic age, and it kind of has to do with how things are going with this NSA data collection stuff. There's all these, you know, cell phone records and text records and everything else that we're doing these days on social media that the founding fathers really didn't have any concept of, and then we need to figure out how to apply the Constitution to that. And her suggestion was maybe we ought to decide whether or not, you know, we have a reasonable expectation of privacy in our location.
That's a radically different sort of interpretation than the way Scalia interpreted, which is largely grounded, it seems like, in the notion of property rights. But I guess that doesn't particularly surprise me when I look at Scalia's philosophy.
Well, there was a second case on the Fourth Amendment. It was a Florida versus Jaridnes, I believe, J-A-R-I-D-N-E-S, also written by Scalia. And in this case, officers took a drug-sniffing dog to this defendant's front porch where the dog gave a positive alert for narcotics. And it was based on that that the officers obtained a warrant for the search. And the question was that bringing the dog up to the front door and letting the dog sniff, was that a search? And Scalia wrote this opinion as well. And, you know, as Eric pointed out, when Scalia issues a decision, he goes way back. So I have the case here. He actually cited from the laws of England, year 1769. And when he analyzed the case, he went back to the Fourth Amendment, which he likes to go to the source document, and says, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. So because the word house appears in the Fourth Amendment, he stands by the rationale that the house is sacred. And he quotes from another case from a little bit younger than the one before, but at the Fourth Amendment's very core stands the right of a man to retreat into his own home and there be free from unreasonable government intrusion. Based upon that, he holds that the dog sniffing was a search, and as a result, it being done without a warrant was unreasonable. You know, that, I think, if you contrast that with a car, I guess part of me wishes that when this country was founded that automobiles were around, because presumably the founders would have included cars in the Fourth Amendment as well, and we have the same protection. Unfortunately, we don't. And if you're in a car driving around and they want to have a dog move around your car, they can do that, and it is not a violative of your Fourth Amendment rights as it is with a house.
You would have think that maybe the founders could have included horse-drawn carriages, perhaps?
Yes, something like that. Something to make it seem... Because we do. I mean, when I'm driving in my car, it's my personal space. I have an expectation of privacy. I wonder openly if this expectation of privacy that Scalia doesn't like, perhaps, or didn't want to go down that road, is related to some of these other cases that are more social issues. Same-sex partners, things like that. Yeah. He just didn't want to go there because he views the expectation of privacy and those rights as not being grounded necessarily in the Constitution, so he wants to stay away from it.
That's an interesting thought. Now, speaking of dog cases, the Florida versus Jardines was not the only dog case out there.
There were the year of the dog in the Supreme Court, right? Yeah, so there was this other case... Florida v. Harris, where the police used the dog, as Dave was talking about, used the dog to search a car at a car stop. A fellow was pulled, Mr. Harris was pulled over for having expired tags, and because the officer thought he was acting nervous and had a beer can in the car, he thought this was suspicious, so he ran his drug dog around. Now, when he ran the drug dog around, according to the officer, the dog alerted, and he searched the car based on this alert because under Supreme Court precedent, that's probable cause. And so now the officer, and because it's a car, as David mentioned, that was good enough. So he does a warrantless search of the car, and he finds a whole bunch of Sudafed pills and muriatic acid and like 1,000 matches. And they charge Mr. Harris with having the precursor materials for manufacturing methamphetamines. But note that there were no drugs. He didn't find any drugs. He just found a bunch of Sudafed and matches. About 2 months later, while he's out on bond, they pull Mr. Harris over again, same officer, same dog, and again, they run the car, dog around the car, and the dog alerts, and this time they don't find anything. So they filed a motion to suppress, Mr. Harris did, saying, hey, this dog keeps having false alerts. You cannot rely on this dog without any other, you know, you got to prove that this dog is reliable, and it seems to me the dog is not reliable. That's not good enough for probable cause. And the Florida Supreme Court ended up agreeing with Mr. Harris and came out with this long list of evidentiary stuff that the police should have, that the state should have to produce when they're using dogs to prove it's a reliable instrument. You know, to prove that the dog is more reliable than a coin toss. And the United States Supreme Court disagreed. The United States Supreme Court unanimously said that no, the state is not required to produce the documents showing that the dogs are reliable. Now, and really, I'm not sure that it is a huge, huge decision, because the Florida Supreme Court had said under the federal constitution, there are all these things that they've got that the police have to do to prove the dog is reliable before they can use it for probable cause. And the Supreme Court basically said, we disagree with that. We're going to presume that the dog is reliable, and then the defendant can still attack that. And I guess the problem is, for the defendant, if the officers are not keeping track of the dog's rate of false positives, how are we going to be able to attack it? If there's no documentation, how are we going to be able to address the issue? So, and you know, the police and the government's position is those are not false positives. The government's position is there were drugs there once, and the dog is smelling a residual odor, so it's not a false positive.
Well, considering that virtually every piece of U.S. currency that's in circulation, from what I understand, has trace amounts on it, that could be the case for virtually anything then. So how do you derive any meaning from that?
Well, right. And as David mentioned, you know, if you're driving a rental car that somebody, the last renter, had some marijuana in or something, you could be subject to a search because of, or if the dog just, you know, the dog just got excited and made a move that the trainer thought was an alert.
I mean, I think part of the problem is,
personally, I don't speak dog, and so I can't right. figure out, is the dog sitting? Is the dog tired? Is the dog happy? Does the dog want food? Does the dog want the ball? Or does my client have drugs in his car? And so I can't tell, and that creates a certain amount of frustration with me, you know, personally. And I say it somewhat facetiously, but also there's some truth there. I can't tell what the hell the dog's doing. And I've seen them on tape, and they walk around the car, and the dog sits a certain place, but I don't know. I have a pet at home, and the animal sits every once in a while. Is he alerting on something? I don't know. And so that creates a certain amount of frustration. The problem, even more so, is that there's no expectation of privacy that we all, I think, have in our car is not really recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court. That's the real problem. And so when they want to take the drug dog around the car, to me that's a violation, whereas Scalia's even agreed that same behavior in the front of my house, where Girl Scout or Boy Scout's allowed to come on my property without my express permission, but if a police officer is with a dog, that violates my Fourth Amendment rights, but the same behavior with my car does not. So, anyway, that's...
Speaking of privacy and privacy issues, there was an interesting case that came out of the state of Missouri involving blood and the ability of the police to take blood samples from suspects. What happened there?
It was a DWI arrest, and the... what was the case? Mr. King, or no?
Missouri versus McNeely.
McNeely. Mr. McNeely, that's right. Mr. McNeely refused to give a blood sample or a breath test, and so the officer took him to the hospital and ordered the blood test to be taken anyway, and without a warrant. And so that was really the issue, is can the police, because of exigent circumstances, because the government's position is, hey, every minute that goes by, his body is expelling the alcohol, and so if you wait until you get a warrant, then it's going to be too late. We're not going to be able to have our evidence and prove it. And the Missouri Supreme Court said, no, that's not good enough, especially in this day and age when, you know what, police officers and prosecutors and judges are using text messages and faxes to get their search warrants, to do their statements of probable cause or whatever, and get their, or their affidavits and get their search warrants. And so you don't, the circumstances are not necessarily that exigent. And so they said, basically, the Supreme Court said, we're gonna go with what the Supreme Court of Missouri said. They got it right and say that you got to look at the totality of the circumstances, whether or not you can do a warrantless blood draw.
Just real quick, I think to me the case was decided based on the following imagery. If you can imagine a law enforcement officer being able to hold a suspect down on a gurney, strap them down, stick a needle in their arm to extract blood, to me that is the best example of a violation of Fourth Amendment rights. And I think that imagery in and of itself probably had something to do with the court's decision.
Which is surprising, though, that it wound up being a 5-4 split on the in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, I don't know who the four were, but I could probably guess who the four were. But yeah, I don't know. It's a scary thought that even had to be put up for debate.
We're going to take a very short break now to listen to some announcements. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM. This is Robin Martinez. I'm a member of the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. And today we're talking about important developments in the world of law over the last year. With me is Attorney Eric Vernon and Attorney David Bell. We've been talking about some of the recent Supreme Court decisions that have dealt with everything from reasonable expectations to privacy and whether or not we as citizens even have an expectation of privacy, all the way to the issues relating to the reasonability of searches. And we talked about the Missouri versus McNeely case involving the officers or police officers' ability to draw blood from suspects without a warrant. David and Eric, that wasn't really the only case involving collecting samples of from suspects. There was another case, Maryland versus King, that went up to the Supreme Court that dealt with Maryland's law enforcement's ability to collect DNA from people charged with violent crimes while they were in custody, all without a warrant. Any thoughts on that particular case?
Well, and along the lines of what David's been saying, is I think it's kind of disturbing. Basically, Maryland has this law that says that anybody that's arrested on a violent felony has to give up a sample of their DNA without any other showing of probable cause, without a warrant. They just blanket, if you're arrested for a violent felony, you have to give up a sample of your DNA. And based on that, I'm sure Maryland is creating this database of its citizens' DNA, and the Supreme Court validated that.
And so, you know, again, contrasting this to Missouri McNeely, and DNA tests are taken merely by a swab against the inside of your cheek. There's the cells that come off onto the swab, and that's it. It's a painless procedure. I've seen it done a number of times. I've never had it done to me, nor would I want it done to me, which is part of the problem. You know, I think one of the issues that we have now is fingerprints have become such a common part of our scheme that no one says anything about it. DNA is now the next step in the fingerprinting, and it's probably more accurate than fingerprinting. But what Eric had mentioned is that there's now going to be a database of this information. And once it's in there, the concern I've got is how then is it going to be used? And, for example, are they going to run the DNA throughout the entire country through a federal database? The second thing is, at some point, and this I think this will probably happen, are employers going to require new employees to submit the DNA test that are then run in this criminal database just like they are with fingerprints? So there's a lot of what I'll call collateral consequences out there that I'm concerned are not being thought through in cases like this.
That all ties back to the entire issue of whether or not we as individuals have a reasonable expectation of privacy, then, does it not?
That's exactly right. And I think the law presumes, which we can debate about, the law presumes that people are, that innocent people don't have a problem with this. You'll hear some people say, well,
I don't have a problem with people searching my house. I didn't do anything wrong, or I don't have any problem with people searching my car. Generally, I hear those responses from individuals who have never had their house searched or have never had their car searched or have never been handcuffed on the side of the road while they were stopped for speeding so someone could search their car.
Tell you what, let's go ahead and open the phone lines up for callers. If you're interested and if you've got any particular questions that you would like to pose of our panelists here, please feel free to call. The telephone number to here at the studio is 816-931-5534. Please feel free to call in with your questions. Meanwhile, let's talk about one more important Supreme Court decision that kind of came to the forefront this last year, and that was Salinas versus Texas. A rather interesting case, and one that that I think has some very serious Fifth Amendment consequences. Would either of you be willing to weigh in on that case?
Sure. This is David. You know, let me just be clear. A certain segment of the current Supreme Court do not believe that Miranda is valid law. Okay, the Miranda v. Arizona decision is not valid law to a certain portion of the court. That would be Alito, Scalia, and Roberts for sure, and Thomas.
And for those of our listeners who may not know, what is the Miranda decision?
Miranda decision says, essentially indicates that if you're in custody, and that we can talk about what that means, and if you're being asked questions to elicit incriminating responses, then you have to be given your Miranda rights, which are you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. If you can't afford an attorney, one will be appointed for you. And that failure to give those rights could result in what you say after that being excluded from the trial. The problem, as seen from a certain portion of the court, is that's nowhere in the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment basically says you can't be compelled to testify against yourself. Miranda arose from that. And there's been a constant attack on Miranda, and this Texas case is a continuation of it. And basically what happened in this case was someone voluntarily went to the police station, was told they were free to leave, and so we have to assume those as the facts of the case. And the person was then asked a number of questions to which he provided answers, and then he was asked a question with regard to whether the shotgun shell casings found at the scene would match his shotgun, to which he then fell silent. The prosecutor then used that silence at trial against him and said, well, he answered all these questions. He didn't answer this one. Obviously, an innocent person wouldn't behave in this fashion. And the court held that that was okay, that the suspect's silence in response to a specific question posed during the interview when the suspect was not in custody and had been voluntarily answering other questions could be used against him in court. Now, the problem with that is that when that's brought out by the government in their portion of the case, a defendant has a decision to make as to whether or not the defendant is going to testify at trial. Defendant has an absolute right not to testify at trial, and that failure to testify cannot be used against him. So the prosecutor can't get up and say, well, he never testified at trial, therefore he must be guilty. What the Miranda decisions and some of these other Fifth Amendment decisions were doing was going, all right, we're going to go before trial, and we're going to go to the point where there's law enforcement contact. The question is, if someone remains silent at that point, can that silence be used against them? And the courts are slowly basically holding that silence can be used against them. Now, this was in a pre-Miranda factual situation. If he had been Mirandized and if he had remained silent, there's an issue as whether or not that silence would be or could be used against him. What's important here to note, and what they're saying here in this case as well as others, is that you cannot invoke your right to remain silent by being silent. In order to invoke your right to remain silent, you have to say something, which sounds a little bit odd, but you have to say, I'm invoking my right to remain silent, or I want my attorney present. You have to affirmatively invoke it, or else you're at risk of losing it.
So that almost comes into play then, and right from the outset, almost with any type of police contact then. So it sounds like it almost really behooves individuals to be fully aware of their rights and right off the bat refuse to answer any questions, period.
Well, I don't know about anybody ever having to come into contact with police not answering any questions, but I will say that I advise my clients. In fact, sometimes when I have clients that are being investigated by police, I have them practice saying out loud several times, "I want my lawyer," just to make sure it's because they do, because they, in order to stop the investigate or to stop the questioning and to prevent them from their silence from being used against them, they need to affirmatively invoke.
No, and that's really the problem. You're presumed to know the law, and you're presumed to know your rights, and so your failure to know those is not necessarily an excuse for failure to exercise. So, if you're in a situation where you're being interrogated by police, whether or not you've been given Miranda or not, and you don't want to be there and you don't want to answer any questions, it's important that you say, and I add a little bit extra to Eric's admonition. I make it a little bit friendlier. I have my client say, "You know, officer, I'd love to talk to you, but I want my attorney present." And what will happen is, and just to be clear, and this, we were watching Law and Order last night. My wife and I were watching Law and Order, and there's a scene where always these scenes where someone's being interrogated, and all of a sudden you hear a knock at the door, and the detective's like, "Oh my God, the attorneys show up," and all this stuff. Well, that doesn't happen in real life because the individual actually has to invoke. The attorney cannot come in from the outside. So I just wanted to clear the air on that one. But the individual, if they're in the situation, they need to affirmatively say they want their attorney. And at that point, officers will not go out and get the attorney to bring them in. And the reason is they know that the first thing Eric and I would say when we got into that room to our client was, "Shut up. You're not saying anything more." And so as a result, the police will end the interrogation at that time.
Now, that covers some of the Fourth and Fifth Amendment issues that the Supreme Court looked at this last year. But I understand there was also an important Sixth Amendment case that was decided. And the Sixth Amendment essentially provides people with a right to a jury, and that was Allen versus United States. Eric, do you have any thoughts on that, or David?
Well, and just, I mean, that was one we talked about earlier in the when we were talking about drug policy, and essentially the court said if the government wants to enhance your sentence, if the government wants to say not only were you involved in a drug conspiracy, but you were involved in a drug conspiracy to move X amount of drugs, which therefore gives you a mandatory minimum of 10 years, a jury has to decide that, as opposed to in the past. The argument has been that, well, once you're guilty, whether by jury or by a plea, we'll just let the judge decide by a preponderance of the evidence whether or not, you know, you sold enough drugs to get the mandatory minimum. And the Supreme Court in this case said, no, really, that's a jury issue. That is an element of the offense. It's a jury issue, and so a jury has to decide beyond a reasonable doubt whether or not you met the requirement for that mandatory minimum or that enhancement.
I think where you see that come in a lot in federal cases, which this is one, is what's called relevant conduct. And so I could plead guilty to one charge of theft of any amount at the federal level, and it wouldn't be called theft, but let's just assume that for discussion. And then subsequent to my plea and at sentencing, the court could then go out and look to all of my relevant conduct. So maybe I pled guilty to stealing $100,000, but my relevant conduct then pushes that up to $2.5 million. And like drug cases, economic crimes are also sentenced based upon the amounts. And so that's part of the problem. And I guess this case is saying that for mandatory minimums, we're not going to do a preponderance of the evidence. The judge isn't going to decide. The jury needs to decide. Now, of course, that is a victory to a certain extent, but I think the rate of conviction at federal jury trials is still probably over 90%. So,
right. Well, that's actually another example is the gun enhancement, right? In federal drug conspiracies, if you commit the crime and you use a weapon, use a firearm, then it increases the mandatory minimum by at least 5 years. And so, if you know, like I've got a case where there was a guy in a house, they found the drugs with the client in the house, and there was a gun in the house but not in his room. It was like in the kitchen, and the government wants to get the extra 5 years because he used a gun. But it's a question whether or not it was actually his gun, whether he used it in conjunction with selling drugs, or whether it was just there in the house. And so now that would be up to a jury to decide if we tried the case.
You're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio.
This is Robin Martinez. I'm an attorney with the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. With me today are attorneys Eric Vernon and David Bell, and we're talking about some of the important legal developments that have occurred over the last year. And we've been talking about the U.S. Supreme Court and drug policy and a lot of issues on the national level. Let's shift a little bit over to what's occurring here in Missouri and even in the Kansas City metropolitan area, just to inform our listeners. And also, we're also open up to opening up the lines for callers in case anybody does have any questions or would like to join the discussion. Feel free to call the studio, 816-931-5534. Now, meanwhile, there's been a lot of turnover here in the local court system with a lot of changes in the judges that we have. What's been happening?
Well, just as you said, there's been a lot of turnover, and I think this is significant partly because, you know, for the last several years, every year there's been a move afoot to change the nonpartisan court plan, the Missouri plan, and I think it's significant to point out that this year we've had quite a bit of turnover. We've got one new in this area. We've got one new judge on the Western District Court of Appeals, Judge Gabbert, who came from the circuit in Clay County. In Platt County, we've got two new circuit judges, and we're working on getting two new associate circuit judges. In Clay County, we've got a new circuit judge and a new associate circuit judge. And in Jackson County, let me count, we've got five or six new circuit and associate circuit judges. And all of them have been appointed through the nonpartisan court plan. And I think fairly universally, from what I hear in the community, these were all excellent choices. These are all going to be excellent, outstanding judges, and it's somewhat frightening that, you know, the Secretary of State just approved a couple of petitions, I guess. They're out there collecting petitions. The folks that want to change the court plan to elect our judges are out there collecting signatures right now to try and change it, and I think that's kind of frightening. And I hope we, you know, the citizens of the state of Missouri don't change the plan.
Can you take a step back and maybe explain for our listening audience what exactly the Missouri nonpartisan court plan is?
Well, yeah, the Missouri nonpartisan plan, essentially at the circuit level, which is Jackson County, Clay County, Platt County, we have these judicial nominating commissions. They're made up of two citizens that are nominated by the governor, two lawyers that are elected by the local bar, and the presiding judge from the Court of Appeals. People, lawyers who want to apply, submit applications, they go through a public interview, and after this public interview, there's the commission sits and creates a slate of the top three contenders and sends that slate of three nominees to the governor, who then picks one.
And then after a period of time, is it 6 years or? I think it's 6 years, then the judge doesn't stand necessarily for re-election, but for retention, which winds up, they're almost all, I think there always have been retained, I'm not sure.
Well, there's been a few.
Not in my experience so far, but I'm sure prior to me coming on board. But what it does is it creates a certain, a certain continuity in the bench, and I think that's important. I'm a supporter of the nonpartisan court plan, and the reason is while you'll never be able to take politics completely out of the judiciary, you sure as hell want to do it as much as possible. And the reason you want to do it is you don't want to elect someone based upon how they decided a particular case, or even more likely, how that particular case was reported in the newspaper. Rather, you want to pick someone based on their experience over their career. And I think the way that the plan handles it now, with the open interviews, the attorneys, the non-attorneys, the judges to be able to select the panel, and finally the governor selecting from that, I think what balances all of those various interests in there. The worst part of the situation is being in an outlying county and being in front of a judge, and you've got a tough decision that you know the judge has to make. The right decision is for your client, but it's not the politically best decision for the judge. And so what's the judge going to do? The judge wants to be up for re-election next year. The local paper is going to report it. And now you're concerned about whether the right decision is going to be made based upon political concerns rather than based upon the law.
So is this effort to push a petition to change the Missouri nonpartisan plan, are they looking to essentially get judges elected as opposed to appointed through this process?
You know what, it's always a little bit different, and I haven't seen the most recent petitions, but generally, yeah, they want to either elect the judges or find a more streamlined and more politically suspect way of appointing them.
We've got a caller on air. Could you please introduce yourself?
I'm enjoying the conversation. This is Doc from Kansas City. I'm wondering what the average citizen can expect traveling through the state of Kansas to and from Colorado to go out to Colorado for some cannabis tourism. What do you expect the law enforcement presence to be?
Well, we can field that question, I believe.
Are you?
Thanks.
I would be more concerned on the return trip than on the going out there trip. But on the return trip, well, I guess part of the problem is that you can be stopped for any objective reason, and that could mean anybody not maintaining their lane properly, or maybe their tire crosses over the white line for a moment, or maybe you're going 56 and a 55. All of those reasons can be used to stop you, and then once they stop you, you're going to appear nervous, and that'll probably get them into the car. So, Eric, what do you think? What are your yeah?
Well, I agree. I would be driving the speed limit. Be careful. If you do get pulled over, be polite. Exercise your rights. You know, if you have concerns, tell the officer. Be polite, but say, you know, I'm in a hurry, and I really don't have time to allow you to search my car.
Or the best thing is just, like Vegas, just keep whatever you're going to do in Colorado. I think that's probably the safest thing.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering, really, if you just anticipated them being real hard.
Oh, yeah.
Escalating and stepping
yes,
it up.
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're coming back from Colorado in a Missouri car or a rental car, I think you can expect a little bit more attention than you would otherwise receive for a number of reasons. One, they know it's all coming out of Colorado. Not all of it, but a good deal of it's coming out of Colorado. And the second thing, a lot of these local jurisdictions depend upon the revenue generated from stopping you and incarcerating you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of that already going on anyway. I've been pulled over many times with very little probable cause, but it's more about my appearance than anything else. So
anyway,
all
go
right.
to Colorado
and
yeah, enjoy yourself, and I would just keep the enjoyment in Colorado.
Yeah, thanks.
I think that's good advice for anyone wishing to engage in cannabis tourism to either Colorado or even to Washington State. We'll see where that goes. Tell you what, it is 9:53. We have to wrap at this point. I appreciate both of you coming in and sharing your thoughts on air with us today. This has been, I think, a very interesting discussion. There's a lot of material to think about that has occurred both nationally and locally over the past year. And once again, this has been Robin Martinez, a member of the Kansas City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, here today with attorneys David Bell and Eric Vernon. And wish you all a happy new year.
Ready? One, two, three. Sitting here in my problem. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know. Maybe I'm supposed to cry. If nobody ever knows the way I feel, that's all right.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We thank our engineer Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clemmer on Thursdays, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Friday. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Echo Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Siesta Music.
Drug War News. 7-year-old Brave Makayla uses medical cannabis to help with her cancer, but upon seeing road signs disparaging the use of medical cannabis, this is what she had to say.
How did it make you feel?
It made me feel sad, and it hurt my feelings, and there's lots of uses for cannabis. It can help you eat, it can help you sleep, and it can all the sicknesses, and it also helps you feel like a normal person.
Oh yeah? What should they do with those signs?
Take them down and put a different sign up that says cannabis can help cure sickness.
Oh yeah? What sickness did it help you cure?
It helps me cure cancer.
What kind of cancer?
Leukemia. And it after 3 days after I had cannabis, I was in remission.
Yeah? So you think those signs should come down and they should never put anything like it up again?
No. I think they should put cannabis here.
All right, sweetie. I'm going to let everybody in the world know. We're going to put this video online, okay?
Okay.
Say hi, I'm Brave Makayla.
Hi, I'm Brave Makayla.
And now, a few thoughts to help welcome 2014. 2014 is the year we swing the cat, the year we shame, embarrass, and belittle the ignorance and folly of politicians, media barons, religious leaders, prosecutors, and judges. We must challenge the logic and direction of these individuals at every opportunity to bring forward the topic of drug prohibition. Why do they stand eternally in support of terrorists brave enough to grow forbidden flowers? How do they sleep knowing their belief system ensures billions for bastard Mexican cartels and tens of thousands of deaths each year? By what rationale do they negate the fact that their demand for more drug war is 100% responsible for the growth of more than 30,000 violent U.S. gangs, many of whom are now aligned with the terrorists and cartels? Each day, we are inundated with stories of corrupt cops, judges, prosecutors, politicians in bed with the drug traffickers. The 100 years of escalation and the pervasiveness of the corruption and rot has numbed the minds of Americans to the horrors we inflict on ourselves via this policy. America can no longer stand idly by, choosing to represent blind ignorance over the reality we know to be true. Constrained, at work, at church, by neighbors, who feel just like you, this drug war needs to end. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.